Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Not one, but two corrupt motives ignored by our so-called free press. Why NATO are determined to wipe out Libyan leader Gaddafi and all his family. And is Tesco set to take over Britain, selling us everything we eat, everything we wear, all our fuel, all our insurance, and being our bankers too? Mike Birkin from Southwest Friends of the Earth is here explaining that as Tesco's gradually expands, maybe every little is hurting our community. And it's that heady hotbed of radical politics that challenges the status quo every year. Bristol's Anarchist Book Fair takes place tomorrow at Hamilton House in Stokes Croft. No doubt the undercover police will be down there, but will you? We hear from two of tomorrow afternoon's speakers. And delayed from last week, we also look at emergency planners' provision of potassium iodate tablets. These are one of the most important indications of preparedness for nuclear fallout from other parts of the world, or even a terror attack on one of our nearby nuclear power stations. But first, the attack on Colonel Gaddafi. The supposed death of Osama bin Laden has been totally overshadowed. Has totally overshadowed NATO's attempt to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi's youngest son, Colonel Gaddafi himself, and actually killing his youngest son and three of his grandchildren. They were aged 3 years, 2 years and 4 months old. And on last night's BBC Question Time, the assassination of Gaddafi's son was not even discussed. So we'll have a chat with Martin Summers about that now. Martin, what are your thoughts? We did discuss the killing of Osama bin Laden earlier on, but what about this assassination of Gaddafi's son?
Well, there have been attempts to kill Gaddafi a number of times. I mean, the Gaddafi plot in the 1990s, exposed by Annie Machen and David Shaler, they were working with the Islamic Fighting Group, who are actually the core fighting element within the rebel coalition, and also Al-Qaeda Libya, to try and blow up Gaddafi in those years. I mean, Gaddafi has been a thorn in their side for many years. Gaddafi, of course, is not necessarily a good guy. I'm not trying to defend him. But he's somebody they don't like, let's face it.
What about the whole principle of actually just killing foreign leaders?
Well, it's sauce for the goose, it's sauce for the gander. If you ask John Major and Margaret Thatcher about that, the IRA nearly killed both of them, just unlucky on the day. And if that's the way we're going, that's the way we're going to end up. Look behind you, David Cameron.
Well, yes, but I mean, surely this is a war crime.
Yes, because what's a war crime? What we do is what we do, and what they do is criminal activity. I mean, we were talking about this earlier. We've got to get to a rule of law. The killing of the PSNI guy Ronnie Kerr in Northern Ireland the other week demonstrated that the whole community there is determined to have a rule of law. And that's how you stop terrorism from any side. There's got to be a rule of law. One rule for you and the same rules for us. And that goes for the state, it goes for people fighting the state. There's one rule book and everybody's got to obey it. But of course, this is nothing to do with this at all.
Well, this is what Stephen Lenman has to say, and he's from the website globalresearch.ca.
This was an attack on a civilian structure. This was Gaddafi's personal compound. They murdered three of his grandchildren, one of his sons. Well, I think they're very delighted to have gotten rid of anybody with the name Gaddafi or associated with him. But they really wanted to get him, and they're not done trying. The idea is to kill him. This was a war crime. But of course, being in Libya at all is a war crime. All of the complicit NATO countries are committing war crimes every single day, attacking civilian targets, killing civilians.
The bombings sparked riots, with Gaddafi supporters storming the Italian and British embassies in protest. And some believe, should the coalition forces continue on their chosen course in Libya, the situation will go from bad to worse.
That was an extract from a report on Russia Today about the killing of Gaddafi's son. And actually, apparently Gaddafi was in the building himself. And where is all this heading, Martin? Because surely the NATO are simply not going to give up until all of this family are dead.
As we mentioned on this programme before, people can check it on globalresearch.ca, Canadian website. The French Air Force had an exercise attack a country called Southland with a dictator unnamed who would carry out reprisals against his own people and would lead to a UN resolution which would lead to the French and British Air Forces.
Hang on, that's not an exercise. That's what happened.
Yes, it was called Operation Southern Mistral 2011. It's been up on the French Air Force website since November last year. It was due to kick off on March the 25th, and Operation Odyssey Dawn kicked off on March the 19th, exactly the same as the exercise. Denis Kucinich, who's a Democrat congressman in the US, has already raised this on the floor of Congress, saying, well, look, it looks as if there was an ongoing plan to do what's happened in Libya. It hasn't been a series of coincident events. In actual fact, there was a war plan developed last year by the Western powers to attack Libya. That war plan is now in operation. And that, I think, I was quite confused by what was happening at first, because I don't like to see people be massacred by anybody. And I'd got some sympathy for the rebels in Libya. But at the same time, if it's all being planned in advance by the Western powers, then that's a different matter, isn't it?
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Right, well, I'm joined now. We're going to be going back to the whole Libya issue later on, but I'm joined for the time being by Mike Birkin from Bristol Friends of the Earth. Hi, Mike. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good evening.
Now, we have the situation in Stokes Croft, which is just around the corner from the Friends of the Earth Southwest Regional Office. What are your thoughts and Friends of the Earth's thoughts about the whole Tesco debacle? We were discussing with Helen Holland just now the power of the supermarkets, but what's Friends of the Earth's position on all this?
We are very, very concerned about it. I mean, the four giant supermarket companies now control over three quarters of the food economy of the UK, and this is people are obviously concerned about what's happening locally in Stokes Croft, because they perceive Tesco to be a threat to locally owned businesses. But the point about the dominance that Tesco and others are now achieving is they're working right through the food chain, so they're able to dictate terms to farmers as well as to local high streets and consumers. So it's not just what we see in the high street, it's the whole food chain, right through from production through to what ends up on our plate. It's being increasingly dominated by a small number of companies.
Well, this is for me, this is like echoes of the old Standard Oil, the massive octopus company that took over the oil industry in the early part of the last century in the United States, the Rockefeller Empire, where they were controlling not only the drilling rigs, they were controlling also, in fact, in many cases secretly, the transport, the rail transport of oil around America, and then also the petrol stations themselves. So what is the problem with a company that is doing this all the way through the chain, and in this case the food chain?
The problem is that it gets increasingly difficult for any more adventurous forms of food production and consumption to get a foothold in that market. It's increasingly a one-size-fits-all market that, you know, nobody else gets a look in. So, for instance, because of the dominance of these major retailers, farmers and producers in the UK are increasingly being driven to follow the same business model, which is cutting costs, producing an identikit product at cheapest possible rate to get it onto the supermarket shelves, where it's exactly the kind of thing that the supermarkets want to market.
But isn't it, in a way, Tesco's are just passing on to the farmers and the producers the demands of the consumer? And the consumer wants, consumers want their, for example, their tomatoes to be all spotless and the right size and cheap.
Yeah, to what extent the consumer is actually in the driving seat in this process, I think, is open to some debate. If all you can get is identikit tomatoes, then the majority of consumers are going to end up buying those because they don't have any choice to do anything else. For a large part of the population of Bristol now, particularly the people in the poorer wards in the centre of the city, they don't have anywhere much to buy food other than supermarkets. Fresh food is entirely controlled by them, and so it's not really, to talk about consumer choice in such a situation is increasingly becoming an illusion.
And to what extent do these supermarkets collude? You know, because I know one of the things that that they did collude on was this whole business of GM labelling, and whether it's going to be actually part of the labelling requirements to have it on a label as you're buying the food, to say whether it's genetically modified food or not. Because I would have thought for many people, if it actually said that, they wouldn't be buying the genetically modified food.
Yes, supermarkets were caught out by the strength of consumer feeling against GM 10 years ago, and started saying, you know, we won't be carrying it in our products.
Well, as I remember, Iceland were the first one to do that.
Yeah,
but we still can't actually look on the label and see whether something's GM or not.
They're slipping away from that promise, and in particular, it's getting increasingly difficult to work out if there's been a GM input at some point during the food chain that led to the product being on your plate. So if you buy beef, you know, it's probably been fed, or poultry and dairy, it's probably been fed at some point, the animal that produced that milk, or that's end up, you know, in the packet on the supermarket shelf, has been fed a GM product at some point in its life, and that isn't controlled or labelled through the system we have at the moment.
What about things like pesticides? Because I know that particularly salad products, when they're on the supermarket shelf, we don't even know what pesticides are on that product. That actually, what a lot of these supermarkets do to increase the shelf life of salads and things like that, they will spray pesticides on them. Surely that should be labelled, shouldn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think consumers do want to have this information at their fingertips when they choose a lettuce off a supermarket shelf or whatever. And that's one of the problems when you have such a great degree of market control by four large companies. They're not only controlling the market, they're controlling the politicians as well. So you know, there was, on numerous occasions, concerns have been expressed by politicians themselves and by the Competition Commission, for instance, about the dominance of such a small number of companies over the whole food retail business, but nothing effective ever gets done about it because they are in control not only of the market, but they make it, you know, it makes it very difficult for any government to take action against them.
So what are these four supermarkets and what can we do?
Well, the four are Tesco's and Sainsbury's, Asda's and Morrison's. And there's loads of things that we can do, but I'd say, you know, for a lot of people in Bristol, it's quite difficult to find an alternative. But there are, you know, what we should be doing is supporting local businesses that are independent, visiting the farmers market if we're able to.
So where and when is our farmers market?
Our farmers market is every Wednesday from about 9:30 in the morning through until about 2:00 in the afternoon. It's in Corn Street, right in the centre of the city. There are other alternative food outlets around the city that we should be supporting, but also, you know, we've got to take action through the political process, and that of course is where things have gone so horribly wrong in Stokes Croft, because a large number of people said we don't want Tesco here, and found that politically their voice was ended up being impotent.
Before we let you go, there's something in the Evening Post today on the front page, although I actually get annoyed by calling it the Evening Post because they don't even have any election results in here. It's really the Morning Post, isn't it? Maybe they should be done under the Trades Descriptions Act, calling it the Evening Paper, because of course it's not, and of course it's printed over in Didcot. But anyway, less of my gripes of the Evening Post and more on this story. It's the new recycling plant will create 125 jobs. Now this, according to you, isn't really best called a recycling plant, Mike, is it?
No, that's right. I mean, this is attached to the major incinerator that company there, CETA, want to build at Avonmouth.
It's quite a nice way of putting it, isn't it? Calling it a recycling plant. It says here a recycling firm says it will create 125 new jobs, supposedly good news anyway, at a plant in Bristol which will convert unwanted plastic into diesel fuel. Now, I didn't know you could convert plastic into diesel fuel and burn it.
Well, what's so green about that?
It might be a bit smelly. I don't know if I wouldn't want to live around the plastic burning diesel fuel plant.
Yeah, I mean, most of that plastic is derived from oil in the first place, so it's just a sort of roundabout and less efficient way of burning oil to drive a vehicle. So I'm not very impressed with the green credentials of that. But we've done some research and into the green jobs potential of boosting recycling. And actually, if you genuinely reduce waste and recycle as much as you possibly can, creates many, many more jobs than the route of sending it to an incinerator.
Okay, and can you just tell us where to find you on the internet, phone number, and if you're having any meetings?
Yep. We've just finished our run of public meetings now, so we haven't got any more immediately planned in the pipeline, but you can find us on bristolfo.org.uk, and that's the best way to find us, or find our national organisation, www.foe.co.uk.
Thanks very much. Mike Birkin from Bristol Friends of the Earth.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, one of the secret motives behind NATO's attempted assassination of Colonel Gaddafi and the killing of his son looks likely to be his proposals for an alternative to the American dollar. Russia Today's London correspondent Laura Emmett reports.
According to some, it's about protecting civilians.
We must not tolerate this regime using military force against its own people.
Others say it's about oil, but some are convinced intervention in Libya is all about currency, specifically Gaddafi's plan to introduce the gold dinar, a single African currency made from gold, a true sharing of the wealth. In the months leading up to the military intervention, he called on African and Muslim nations to join together to create this new currency that would rival the dollar and euro. They would sell oil and other resources around the world only for gold dinars. It's an idea that would shift the economic balance of the world. Countries' wealth would depend on how much gold they have, not how many dollars they trade. And Libya has 144 tons of gold. The UK has double that, but 10 times the population. It's happened before. In 2000, Saddam Hussein announced Iraqi oil would be traded in euros, not dollars. Sanctions and an invasion followed. Some say because the Americans were desperate to prevent OPEC from transferring oil trading in all its member countries to the euro.
The UK's gold is kept here in a secure vault somewhere in the depths of the Bank of England. As in most developed countries, there's not enough to go around. But that's not the case in places like Libya and many of the Gulf states. A gold dinar would have given oil-rich African and Middle Eastern countries the power to turn around to their energy-hungry customers and say, sorry, the price has gone up and we want gold. Some say the US and its NATO allies literally couldn't afford to let that happen. Laura Emmett, RT, London.
Yeah, Russia Today's London correspondent Laura Emmett there talking about the American dollar's demise and Gaddafi's attempt to speed its demise by something called the gold dinar. Martin, what is the gold dinar?
Well, it was originally suggested by the Prime Minister or former Prime Minister of Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad, during the Asian crisis of a few years ago. He said, well, why don't the Islamic countries create their own currency based on gold? Which will basically get rid of the US petrodollar system, because the current financial system is basically that, by agreement with the Saudis, all oil is priced in dollars. And that means that if you want to buy oil, you've got to have dollars, which means that you've got to do things to get those dollars, which means that you basically have to do what the US wants to get the dollars to buy your oil. And of course, various attempts have been made to short-circuit this system and to create something else. Because the dollar has basically been debauched and abused by various US governments over the last 30 years, and everybody else is getting fed up with it.
So what's the point of pinning money in any kind of a dinar or whatever to gold? Because we went off the gold standard in this part of the world a long time ago.
Yeah, I think you've got to distinguish between the Bretton Woods system as designed in 1944 by the Allied powers, with Keynes, the British representative, in the discussions. Keynes didn't believe in the gold standard. He called it a barbarous relic. Yeah? In other words, you don't have to have gold behind your currency. Ultimately, you can just create fiat money, which means that it's just like paper money, if you like. But on the other hand, you need a check and a balance in the system. So the system as designed at Bretton Woods was that the dollar was the world's reserve currency. Keynes suggested a different currency called Bancor, which would not be tied to any particular country, but that Bancor or the dollar would be tied to gold ultimately. The dollar was taken off gold in 1972 by Nixon so that he could carry on printing money to fight the Vietnam War. He didn't want to raise taxes on the wealthy classes in the US to fight the Vietnam War. He wanted to do it on the never never. The only way to do that was to take the dollar off gold. And a lot of the problems we've had since then are as a result of that rather disastrous decision.
So this, you were saying fiat money, that means that the money, the sort of pound notes in our pocket and in our bank accounts, isn't actually backed up by anything.
As it says on your £5 note, it says, I promise to pay the bearer on demand the sum of £5, which signed the Bank of England, the governor of the Bank of England. And in theory, in the old days, you could go in and get your £5 of gold, and that's what it meant. But of course, you couldn't buy £5 of gold with a £5 note these days. And the gold price is rising dramatically as we speak because of all the uncertainties in the world economy. A flight to gold is in fact disastrous because it means that people aren't investing in proper stuff, new factories, new investment, and so on. We need a complete overhaul of the world's currency system with everybody at the table and everybody's interest taken into account. But of course, the existing system is very much to the benefit of the West.
Hasn't that just happened with the, isn't it called the BRICS countries? The Chinese, the Russians, South Africans, and various other countries.
Yes, the Brazilians, the Russians, the Indians, the Chinese, and with the South Africans as kind of observers. Yes, I mean, they're saying, well, let's trade with each other in our own currencies as a means of getting away from the domination of the dollar. The dollar is the world's reserve currency. It basically means if you play Monopoly with the United States as the bank, and that gives them a tremendous advantage. They can run massive budget deficits, for example, and people still want to hold dollars because you need dollars to buy oil. Of course, if there was a revolution in Saudi Arabia and the Saudi Arabians decided not to sell their oil in dollars, but in gold dinars, for example, that would crash the US economy. It's going to crash anyway, but I mean, we're on the brink of these currency turmoil, currency wars. We're right on the edge of it now.
Well, another motive, potentially, to wipe out Gaddafi and his family may be that his people know too much about American government and CIA complicity in the international heroin trafficking using diplomatic bags and diplomatic cover. Last week, I spoke to former American diplomat at the United Nations, Susan Lindauer, who blew the whistle and was promptly arrested and jailed under the Patriot Act. She's just published her real-life spy thriller, as she calls it anyway, Extreme Prejudice.
The book is called Extreme Prejudice, and that's the intelligence parlance for an assassination. My story of my own private assassination and the survival of what they did to me goes back to the cover-up of 9/11 in Iraq. I was the second non-Arab American ever indicted on the Patriot Act after Jose Padilla. And everyone thinks that the Patriot Act is intended to fight terrorism and smash cells that are trying to disrupt society. But in fact, I'm a peace activist and an anti-sanctions activist, and I had worked in anti-terrorism covering the Iraqi embassy for many years, and also covering Libya. And I was not engaged in any sort of activity that would have been construed as violent. Yet, I was arrested on the Patriot Act, thrown in prison on a Texas military base with no trial, no guilty plea, no hearing. I was simply ordered to surrender to prison one day. It was a frightening thing, and once the Justice Department got me into prison, they refused to let me go, and they fought to hold me for 10 years, up to 10 years, on secret charges, secret evidence, secret grand jury testimony. My attorney was not allowed to have free conversations with me. He had to have literally required written permission from the Justice Department to reveal facts about my case to me, the defendant. It was like this appalling Kafkaesque nightmare.
So, what's in the book?
It's a spy thriller. It's a real-life spy thriller. But it's a whole different perspective that you would never have imagined. My book confirms that we absolutely expected 9/11 to happen. It's a historical book in that respect because it tells what was going on before 9/11 and it reveals what was going on with Iraq and Iraq's efforts to contribute to the 9/11 investigation. Everyone has thought that Iraq was pro-terrorist and was really pro-Al-Qaeda, but in fact, Saddam Hussein's government was one of our best sources on anti-terrorism throughout the 1990s. And Saddam tried to give us financial records on Al-Qaeda. They tried to hand over major terrorists to to the United States, and we refuse to take them. And it really makes a lie of the whole anti-terrorist movement in the United States.
You were working for the U.S. government in a connection with Libya. So what were you doing, first of all? And then what do you see is going on in Libya now? What's your perspective on it?
I was supervised by the CIA. And it's very important to know that my CIA handler was on the ground in Lebanon and Syria at the time Lockerbie happened. And so from the very first meeting that we had, he told me that Libya had nothing to do with Lockerbie at all. The real story is much more damning. The CIA had got itself involved in heroin trafficking out of the Bekaa Valley. They allegedly infiltrated the heroin trafficking because they were trying to identify the locations of Western hostages. Terry Waite was one of those, Terry Anderson of AP, Jerry Levin of CNN. There were 96 high-profile Western hostages who were held for years. Terry Anderson was held for 7 years, chained to a basement, beaten, suffering mock executions. These were brutal kidnappings. But the CIA had infiltrated the heroin trafficking, ostensibly to locate where they were being held. But along the way, they started taking kickbacks, and they started making sure that the heroin could get through to Europe and into the United States. So this Defense Intelligence Agency in Washington sent a team with the CIA and the FBI into Lebanon to do a field investigation into the complaints about this double agent and the heroin trafficking. And when this team got on a plane to return to Washington so that they could expose what they had discovered in their investigation, they boarded Pan Am 103, and their plane was blown out of the sky to destroy the evidence and to destroy the knowledge that they had gathered. So this was always about heroin trafficking and covering up the CIA's role in heroin trafficking.
Well, and what about Libya now?
Libya now is a tragedy. I know that a lot of people in Europe are excited about this war. This is an unnecessary war. Libya stopped providing sanctuary to terrorists in the mid-1990s. They abandoned weapons of mass destruction by 2004, I believe. They have tried very hard to rebuild relations with the West. And right up, even in my book, I describe Libya as a great success for back-channel diplomacy. Libya proves that you don't have to go to war to solve these problems. But I will tell you that last summer, this is true, I swear to you this is true, last summer we began hearing that Gaddafi was pressuring U.S. and possibly British oil companies. We know they were doing it to the U.S., and I would presume they were doing it to the British and possibly the French as well. And they were demanding kickbacks for the United Nations sanctions that had been imposed on Libya during the Lockerbie trial. Gaddafi, of course, was very much aware of Libya's innocence of the Lockerbie case, and it had been uncovered that the United States paid witnesses $4 million apiece to testify against Libya. And those witnesses have confessed that they received the money, and they have recanted their testimony. They've said it was a lie. They've said that their testimony was shaped by the United States, and they were told what the United States wanted them to say so they could get the conviction of the one Libyan. It's a very dirty case, and Gaddafi had been forced to pay $2.7 billion in damages to the Lockerbie families, and it turned out that Libya had nothing to do with this. So last summer, he began pressuring the U.S. oil companies to repay Libya. In October, Chevron and Occidental Petroleum, which are American oil companies, pulled out of Libya. And it is my belief that when that happened, the writing was on the wall that the United States was going to take some action to punish Libya and push Libya back in line. But I will tell you, this war is totally unnecessary. It is an oil grab. It is offensive to hear the United States and Britain talk about humanitarian rights after everything they've done in Iraq, Afghanistan. They don't care what happens in Yemen or Bahrain or Syria. Not that I would wish that we should invade any of those countries, but I am a huge believer in diplomacy to solve these problems.
Susan, finally, why should we believe you?
I was a U.S. asset covering Iraq and Libya at the United Nations in New York. That I had about 150 meetings with each of those countries, with ambassadors, senior diplomats. I also was supervised by the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency here in Washington, and I had about 800 to 1,000 meetings with those individuals as well. So I had the New York meetings, and then I had the Washington meetings. And I was an asset from 1995 to 2003, right up to the war. So I know these people very well. I'm very well versed in these issues. My book is Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 in Iraq. And it will blow your mind. It's not an academic book. It is a spy thriller. It's a first-hand account of what actually happened at the Iraqi embassy before the war and before 9/11. And it confirms absolutely that we knew about 9/11. And I personally was instructed to threaten the Iraqi diplomats with war if 9/11 occurred from April and May of 2001 onwards. So for 5 months, we threatened Iraq with war if 9/11 happened.
That was Susan Lindauer. You heard it here first. Extreme Prejudice is her book about what happened to her over the last few years since she was arrested under the Patriot Act simply for telling the truth. And Martin Summers is joining me still. Martin, this whole business of heroin trafficking, what she's saying there is that actually at the top levels, what had happened was some of the senior CIA people and diplomats had been, I imagine, threatened by organised criminals and told to take kickbacks. And they were using diplomatic bags and using these Pan Am flights that Lockerbie was on to actually traffic heroin. And that actually, there was an investigative team on this flight.
Well, I mean, I hear what she says. I mean, it's interesting information, but of course, unless it's verified by other sources, it's just her saying it. But can I comment that it's absolutely proven that the CIA have been involved in heroin trafficking and cocaine trafficking for many years? The Iran-Contra affair, Senator Kerry's committee investigated that. It's quite clear what was going on. Large amounts of cocaine were being brought into MENA Air Base in Arkansas on Bill Clinton's watch, the profits of which were being used to fund the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. That's not conspiracy theory, that's historical fact. And the CIA, and it's not just the CIA, intelligence agencies tend to work with criminals. They've got the same milieu. They've got similar modus operandi. Bank of Credit and Commerce International, for example, was a CIA front bank and very much involved in drug dealing. It's not really news.
But isn't it actually impossible that this whole Libya business is just to squash the real story behind Lockerbie and get a bit of oil?
No, I don't think it's... I mean, Lockerbie was not carried out by the Libyans, as all serious people know. Basically, Libya was set up for Lockerbie. And what Gaddafi was doing with Occidental was saying, look, I took the rap for Lockerbie and I had to pay the compensation to all the families, but you know and I know I didn't do it. So I'm now going to raise my tax rate on you to recoup my losses. And I think that's, you know, basically Gaddafi was not being a good boy in Chicago parlance. You know, he wasn't playing ball with us.
Okay, now what we were just hearing about there is Susan Lindauer. That book, again, is called Extreme Prejudice, and the author is Susan Lindauer.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now on to the Anarchist Book Fair, and one of the highlights at Hamilton House on Stokes Croft right now is the photo exhibition from the Salisbury Hill protests from when the Bath Eastern Bypass was being built many years ago. And I spoke to the photographer who actually put that exhibition together last week.
My name's Adrian Arbib. I'm a photographer, and I covered the Salisbury Hill Road protest way back in 1994. A couple of years ago, I put together a book by the same name, Salisbury Hill, a collection of black and white photos of the road protest.
What was the road protest all about then?
Well, Salisbury Hill was pretty unique in as much as it was the most expensive bit of road ever built in this country. It's around £80 million to build 2 miles of road, and it was part of the then infrastructure that the Conservative government were putting together to build from Southampton a motorway all the way to Bristol and on. And it was a greater plan of the shutting down of the railway system. It was the end game, and it was by connecting all these bypasses up there would be this one Euro route that would run all the way through.
So what was in the way?
Well, that was the problem. Salisbury Hill was an area of outstanding natural beauty, and it was this ancient hill fort, and of course areas of outstanding natural beauty are generally owned by the government, so it was quite easy to get it through the planning process. So it went through the hill, and people came together, and they fought, and it was a muddy, bloody battle for about 6 months actually on the ground, but years in planning.
How many people were actually there protesting then, roughly?
It started off with maybe like sort of 30 or 40 people on the ground, and it sometimes even dwindled down to about 5 people. But then the numbers swelled with marches to 500 to 1,000, and you know, these protests kind of have their own dynamic. And in the winter, obviously, it's freezing cold and raining. It's really grim. But in the summer, the numbers swell, and it builds. But what it did, that ultimately, it beat the government's road building programme. It put a wedge in their £28 billion road building programme, and Salisbury Hill and Newbury and Twyford Down, all these protests stopped the government's road building programme. And I think, you know, without the protesters of Salisbury Hill, we would have seen the tarmacking over of vast areas of England. And it just goes to show, really, that the planning system doesn't really protect us at all. And in the face of a bent planning system, no one wanted this road, only the road builders, only the economic system. In the face of all that, standing up to a planning system is actually a good thing to do.
Now, you've got sort of quite a lot of contrasting pictures here. Some are just sort of beautiful pictures of the countryside that people were trying to save. Others are more humorous. And also, you've managed to capture some of the moments where there's real confrontations going on between the road builders and the protesters.
Yeah, the police generally didn't want to get that involved. It was the first time we'd really seen private security in the countryside, well, anywhere, really. The armies of private security that we now see were heralded actually at Salisbury Hill, and most of them, a lot of these guys had criminal records, so there was no vetting, and some of them were very violent. But the police were generally nowhere to be seen when a lot of the evictions were going on.
Okay, you're doing a talk at the Anarchist Book Fair. Can you tell us where and when that is? And also, where is your exhibition on for the next few weeks?
It's on at Coexist in Stokes Croft, a brilliant venue. I'm actually from Oxford, and I wish we had a place like this. The show's on until the 15th of May, and the talk I'm doing is at the Anarchist Book Fair on Saturday, 2 p.m. on the 7th of May. And it's going to be talking not just about the road protest, but I'm also going to be discussing about injunctions and about how environmental protest has almost been shut down by injunctions. There's a lot of talk about super injunctions in the press at the moment. There's actually a more pernicious injunction system that's going on, which is silencing protests throughout this country.
That was Adrian Arbib, photographer, speaking to me last week. And his exhibition is on. If you can't make it to the book fair tomorrow, just pop into Hamilton House on Stokes Croft. That's on the right-hand side as you're going up with the bar downstairs. Anytime over the next couple of weeks where you can see his photographs of the Salisbury Hill protest. Now, I'm also joined by Alan, who's giving a talk tomorrow. Hi, Alan. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi.
Now, can you tell us what's your talk about? It's called Towards a Living Wage. How on earth do we get towards a living wage? Because I think the main problem is at the moment that we feel, certainly most of us feel, that through things like utility prices, rents, etc., wages being frozen, actually our spending power is being constantly eroded.
Yeah, this is a problem. This is not just a problem for individuals. This is a problem for the government. The government is effectively subsidising employers up and down the country to pay poverty wages. Tax credits, $20 billion a year.
So in what way do tax credits, are they actually getting companies to pay poverty wages? Surely tax credits are there to just help people who aren't getting enough.
Well, companies are not paying a living wage, and they're depending on the taxpayer to top up their employees' wages. And at the other end, they're often not even paying tax at the other end.
But surely it would be worse if there weren't such things as tax credits, wouldn't it?
I would disagree.
Because
I
mean, people wouldn't just have enough to pay the bills, etc. You know, there'd be even more poverty wage.
I would say that the minimum wage is set at such a low level as that it's levelled down the wages rather than levelled them up. And this is led to a poverty trap, and that, you know, people, you know, of on benefits or on low wages or on the same income, getting nowhere. And I would say this is why the explosion of debt has occurred.
But one of the reasons I picked up on your talk, and there are, I must say, there's something like 25 different talks here taking place at Hamilton House between 11 in the morning and around about 6 o'clock in the evening, was because you've got some solutions. The other reason was that also I see structural employment down here. Now, this is something I've been aware of for a long, long time, yeah. Is that big business is constantly been twisting the arm of governments over the last 20, 30 years to actually create a pool of unemployed people, which then gives employers the whip hand over employees. You know, when you're in a situation where you're trying to negotiate with a potential employer, actually, you would think, in any kind of normal world, that the employee would be on a level playing field with the employer. And now, of course, it's moved more and more and more, where the employers can pick and choose wages, conditions, and pick and choose who they want to employ.
I would say that it goes further than that. I think there is a closed shop amongst the employers. They conclude quite happily on fixing wages, while you're not... solidarity action between union members has been made illegal. This is this is not a level playing field.
Okay, so what sort of things are you suggesting then to make things better so that people aren't in this kind of what you call a sort of means-tested poverty trap, basically, with the government picking up at the bill where employers aren't paying enough?
I would suggest that that the wage has to represent your living costs. It should cover your rent, and rent is you know, spiralled after the elimination of council housing and Wilson's rent controls, which that's the biggest chunk of your income if you're working.
So you're saying rent controls were gotten rid of? Now, I don't know.
Thatcher.
Is Margaret Thatcher got rid of control?
Yes.
So what was a controlled rent in the old days then?
It was set as a reasonable level that you could afford, you know, a certain multiple of your income.
Now, so you're coming up with solutions as well. Yeah. Now, you've got probably a list of about 10, 15 different solutions. Can you give us a few of them?
Well,
you mentioned a land tax, for example.
Yeah, land tax, rent controls. I would set. Yeah. But basically, what a living wage should be, it should be possible for a couple to bring up children without claiming means-tested benefits, with either partner working 40 hours or both working 20 hours without claiming means-tested benefit. This is the only economically sustainable, as well as sustainable for the poor individuals that have to work such a low wage.
Now, one of the things you've said here as well is having a maximum wage. Is that wise?
I would say so. I mean, this is as Milton Friedman said, that you could not in the UK in the 70s have full employment without inflation, because unions supposedly kept wages artificially high. But if that's the case, then why is it they consider low wages to be inflationary, but Bob Diamond or all the other kind of people at the top can pay themselves whatever they like, and this is somehow not inflationary? Having high wages at the top is inflationary, therefore there has to be a cap.
Now, just running through a few of these ideas. Oh, no, it's quite a nice little manifesto you've put together here, actually, Alan. Abolishing academy schools, which we are sitting in one at the moment. Renationalise public transport, renationalise public utilities, and reintroduce real education. Abolish pointless target-driven policies. You've got reintroducing full student grants, taking vocational training away from employers, abolishing Trident, abolishing the nuclear programme, repeal anti-democratic legislation,
introduced by Thatcher and New Labour, a proper law on corporate manslaughter involving jail. So, I mean, I don't see the main political parties picking up any of these ideas, Alan. So how does all this integrate, if at all, with our voting that we were doing yesterday?
It doesn't particularly. I just hope that certain parts of the left have picked up living wage and certain other issues, but I hope they put some of their own ideas together, and we can, you know, have proper solidarity action on these issues.
But
across strikes, across the unemployed, across the employed. You know.
But listen, I'm going to put this to you because isn't this a serious problem here? Because you have to have a political platform and you have to have people voting for this in order to get anywhere with this. If you're not able to convince any of the main parties to pick up these ideas, we're just wasting our time, aren't we?
Well, I mean, I think the most effective way, because you have to engage the political process. I'm not kind of being airy-fairy here. But I think what's more effective is outside pressure on them, you know, economic pressure, and eventually, as they did in the post 45 settlement, they will take on these issues because they have to.
Martin Summers is still with us here. Martin, what are your thoughts about what Alan's been saying there and the talk he's been
giving? Well, I mean, I agree with virtually all of that, and I'd say that it is in fact a kind of program for Scandinavian social democracy upgraded for the modern era. The whole idea of having low wages as the basis of your economy is just nonsense. What you want is high wage economy where people are paid well and then they go out and spend the money, and that makes it all work. People used to know this. Even conservative chancellors used to know this. It's all been forgotten. I would pick up on Tony's point, though, that these kind of demands are demands on the state. And that's why I'm not an anarchist, because I can't see, ultimately... I mean, I'm not saying that there's not a space... I believe in decentralisation. I believe that the state should be minimal. I'm all in favour of people doing their own thing insofar as it doesn't impinge on others and all the rest of it. But ultimately, a socialist society will have an element of planning in it, and that implies some kind of state. The question is what kind of state and under whose control.
Okay, so Alan, you can hear him speaking tomorrow at 3 p.m. in the what's called the Book Fair Room, Room 2, that's Level 5 at Hamilton House tomorrow. There's another quite interesting talk I can see here, which is Squatting Law, Squat-tastic Bristol. That's just actually tooling yourself up with the ideas or what the law is on squatting. And another one of the talks is called Benefit Cuts Hurts. Matt, and this is actually not the part of the Anarchist Book Fair. Alan, do you want to tell us about that?
Yes, I'm also part of the Bristol... a subgroup of the Bristol Anti-Cuts Alliance, which is the a social care claimants and welfare subgroup, and we're having a demo outside Flowers Hill to protesting at the changes in incapacity benefit on 12th of May, 3:30 to 5:30 at Flowers Hill off of Bath Road.
And what day is that?
That's May the 12th.
Okay. Okay. And also, Adrian Arbib, just to remind you, the photographer, his talk. I mean, there's too many talks to go through them all here. But another one is at 2 o'clock, and that's Roads to Ruin. Adrian Arbib, did the road protests of the 1990s spawn a new breed of protest? Did it herald the surveillance state we now live in? To quote cops at Preston M65 motorway protest, get the musicians out of the trees first. There's also a cafe on level 3 run by the Cabelli Social Centre Cafe Collective volunteers, serving all day. The food is vegan, cheap, and apparently, anyway, here it says delicious meals, snacks, and hot and cold drinks. And there's also kids and parents space at level 1.5, area for kids and parents to relax. If you need a childminder, ideally contact in advance, and we'll try and arrange a suitable volunteer for you. So that's the Bristol Anarchist Book Fair taking place tomorrow, 7th of May. That's 10:30 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. at Hamilton House. And thanks very much, Alan, for coming in and joining us and telling us about your talk tomorrow. And in a moment, we'll be talking about iodide, potassium iodide, after some music.
It's all
Sharky and the Undertones, It's Going to Happen. I think that was from around about 1986. Not exactly easy to tell from this particular combination, which is the Undertones, Cher and Bowleys. Anyway, back to our news review and our investigative stuff this week. And one of the things that we really maybe should have done earlier on, Marina Morris has been out on the streets of Bristol this week to ask you what you think about the assassination of a large part of a foreign leader's family. That's the Gaddafi family. Martin, just if we can, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, just before we hear that, this, I think, personally, it was has almost been lost, this story, because we had the royal wedding on the Friday, this happened on the Saturday, and then we had the killing of bin Laden. Is this, what do you think is one of those occasions where it was a good day to bury bad news? Because if this is a war crime, as many people think it may be, then it certainly wasn't part of the UN resolution for the NATO forces and for the Western countries to be killing Gaddafi and his family, to actually be targeting the head of state. So what are your thoughts on the way this story has sort of unrolled?
Well, as you pointed out, it's been in competition with various other things that have been going on in the media. But the fact is that there's nasty stuff going on all over the planet all the time. Colombia, we haven't mentioned. People are dying there every day. Trade union activists, social activists being murdered by a government in alliance with our government, being supported with weaponry and money and military support.
But
we don't hear about that, do we?
Assassinations of heads of state is actually, you know, something quite new.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the IRA nearly killed Margaret Thatcher and nearly killed John Major. And if you want to go down that road, go down it, but don't go crying for your mummy when you get there.
Okay, so let's find out what Marina Morris heard from you this week to see what you thought of this assassination of a large part of Gaddafi's family.
What do you think about the assassinations of Gaddafi's son and three granddaughters?
It's wrong. The Libyan thing is about oil and money. Why aren't they invading Iran, or why aren't they, you know, invading those sort of countries? It's just a small country that where there's a lot of money. And they want it. It's as simple as that.
So to me, it all boils down to paper. It all boils down to money. So, yeah.
But I think it's wrong to murder anybody. It's still murder.
That's, for me, a very different thing than the Osama bin Laden thing. Yes, I hoped he would be sentenced and not assassinated.
It was a mistake, though, wasn't it? It wasn't an attack on... It was supposed to get Gaddafi, and Gaddafi had left. It seems strange that he left and left his family there. He can't seem to care that much about them.
If they were largely involved in it, I suppose you could say then that would warrant it. But then if it is, just they were just assassinated just because they're related to him and it's not a no more than that.
It was
then
a
in
attack
that,
on his home.
Then in that case, that
went wrong.
that's not right and that shouldn't really have happened in that instance.
Yeah, I think that was wrong, because children were involved. I think we have enough intelligence to be able to take these people out without affecting...
It's a bit rash, yes.
Yeah.
But I think, on the other hand, you've got to sort him out at somehow or other, because it's the people in the country who are suffering.
Yeah, but then they will also suffer with invasion as well, so it's very difficult.
That was you and your opinions on the killing of Colonel Gaddafi's son and three of his grandchildren and the attempted killing of Gaddafi last Saturday. So, Martin, can you sum up what is going to happen if we start killing off foreign heads of state? Do you think it's possible that we're going to see an increase in terrorism in Britain?
What's significant here is the killing of Gaddafi's son, who was actually being groomed to be the guy to take over Libya if Gaddafi was to go.
He was one of the sons. I'm not sure he was the guy who was his eldest son. I think
but
it was a younger son.
The point is that this war has reached a stalemate. I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia in the 90s, and what we used to say to people is, stop shooting, start talking. What's wrong with that? That's the only way forward.
Okay, and our final story this week is worrying levels of iodine deficiency in Britain, which is even more concerning because it means if there is radioactive iodine out there, from whether it's from an attack, a terrorist attack on a nearby nuclear power station, or from fallout from elsewhere, we need to make sure we've got some. And Bristol City Council have been told me that we have to refer to something called the Radiation Emergency Preparedness and Public Information Regulations for further information, and also that there is some potassium iodide available, but in the old days it used to be able to go and get it almost for a few pennies from chemists, but now it's not available, so we will have to wait to see if they actually distribute it for us. Anyway, that's all for this week. I think we better have more on that potassium iodide story, a full report from Bristol City Council next week. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, who was re-elected as a councillor for Whitchurch yesterday, Helen Holland. Also thanks to Mike Birkin from South West Friends of the Earth, and to Alan, who's doing a talk tomorrow on the social wage at the Anarchist Book Fair on Stokes Croft, and of course Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, the 7-7 inquest, which we didn't cover today. We will be running that out fully and looking at how MI5 misled Parliament and the implications of that. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time next week on thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. Have a good weekend.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody